From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and a year to the day since President Trump was elected, Democrats are cheering a string of election victories across the country, especially in Virginia, where former Republican National Committee Chair Ed Gillespie lost to Democrat Ralph Northam, a pediatric neurologist.
When someone's life is at stake, they don't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. They just want someone to help. That's the way that our administration will govern our Commonwealth. We will put the people of Virginia before politics, before party, and before ideology.
Breitbart News, which only days ago praised Gillespie as a cultural warrior, today called him a Republican swamp thing. And President Trump, who supported Gillespie, was kept at arm's distance by Gillespie, tweeted from Asia, "Ed Gillespie worked hard but did not embrace me or what I stand for."
Well, meanwhile, in New Jersey, the Democrat Phil Murray won the race for governor. He'll replace Chris Christie. Democrats also won mayoral elections from New Hampshire to Florida. And the party flipped control of the state legislature in Washington state, putting Democrats in control of every governor's office and state house on the West Coast.
Our Here and Now political analysts are here. Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
And joining us today, John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And how are you doing? What do you think happened?
You're probably doing a little better than I am right now. But look, as a Republican strategist, I'm certainly not going to deny that it was a very good night for the Democrats. They deserve to be congratulated and enjoy their victory. I think where we got to be very cautious, however, is there's always a tendency after election after this is for everybody to claim victory on their own issue or their agenda and say this is what this was a referendum about. I'm not sure we 100% know what this is a referendum about. I think a lot of it was that the voters gave the Republicans control of the Senate, the House, the White House, even the governorships, and they're still disappointed because they're not seeing a lot of action. And they're not seeing things that are helping people's lives. And so I think we paid a price for that.
Angela?
Yeah, I think that it's not just about policies that have not helped people or they've not seen things move. I think it's more about the fact that they are now seeing policy proposals that would hurt people, directly cause harm, would cost the government tons of money, and also put people's homes and their bodies at a deficit. And I think that that was a major wake-up call for a number of people, including some of the Virginia voters who in exit polls said that health care was their number one issue. Mm-hmm. So lo and behold, we have Republicans who voted to repeal Obamacare both while he was still in office and beyond and can't do it and also can't provide a concrete solution that would ensure people's affordable access to this very important, I think, right. I think the other thing that we saw very clearly is that diversity isn't just important in corporate boardrooms and senior executive leadership positions through in business. It's also important to run diverse candidates because diverse candidates can win statewide and also in local elections.
We saw a lot of women
Absolutely.
Winning. But John, I want to go back to your puzzlement. You know, what happened here? Is this also just the tug of war within your party? Just a few days ago, Steve Bannon said Ed Gillespie offered a roadmap for establishment Republicans, forcing them to embrace his, Bannon's, anti-globalist nationalist platform. Ed Gillespie went way to the right. One of the things that stuck out for a lot of analysts last night is that he was thumping against sanctuary cities. There aren't any in Virginia. And Bannon called this kind of, platform Trumpism without Trump. Is this a sense of that being rejected, or maybe it's just being rejected in that state?
Well, and I think that's the important part. What you said there. I mean, let's be clear. This was not a snapshot last night of how America feels. This was states like Virginia and New Jersey and New York and Washington State that vote overwhelmingly Democrat. And so, well, there's no doubt that Donald Trump and the Republicans have excited the base of the Democratic Party. But let's remember one other thing: the Democrat nominee in Virginia for governor did not run as a progressive, but ran as a middle of the road. And the same is true certainly of Gillespie. Gillespie is not what anybody would consider the far right wing of the Republican Party. He's more of a mainstream.
So did he make a mistake?
Well, I think Ed Gillespie has to be what Ed Gillespie thinks he is. Number two is, let's remember, the president lost Virginia by 5 points in the presidential race. So I think becoming, you know, the second coming of Donald Trump was not going to put you over the finish line in Virginia either.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's, I think we also have to look at the policies that you were just mentioning. I think it's important to note that Ralph Northam also doesn't support sanctuary cities. I think that's not a good thing. Of obviously the protesters who are out there agree with me. And I don't think it was really a sanctuary city decision that folks reached. I also think we would be remiss if we didn't acknowledge the fact that Democrats for the state house flipped 14 seats, and they said that's the largest flip for Democrats since 1899. I don't think we should necessarily say that it's a blue state purple, arguably, right? But we need to acknowledge that there were some major gains.
Well, and let's listen to some of the winners in those down ballot races. Former journalist Danica Rome became the nation's first openly transgender state legislator, defeating the Republican who authored a state bathroom bill restricting transgender access to bathrooms.
To every person who's ever been singled out, who's ever been stigmatized, who's ever been the misfit, who's ever been the kid in the corner, who's ever needed someone to stand up for them when they didn't have a voice of their own, this one's for you.
And former journalist Chris Hurst also won a seat in the House of Delegates. We remember his girlfriend, reporter Allison Parker, was doing a live report when she and her cameraman, Adam Ward, were murdered by a former coworker. This was on DBJ TV back in 2015. On CNN This Morning, Hurst spoke about the effect the shooting had on him.
I, through tragedy, had a shared experience and a common bond with so many people who have gone through tragedy, who have gone through loss. And now, unfortunately, as we have seen in recent events, have also gone through the tragedy and horror of losing a loved one through gun violence. But it connected me to my community. It galvanized me.
John, what do you make of the issues at play in both of those races? One, transgender issues, and one, a response from a victim of gun violence.
Well, I think, first of all, you get the best view of that by looking at some of the exit polling numbers. By way of example, 60-some percent, I believe it was, said that Donald Trump, by way of example, had nothing to do with their vote on Election Day. And then there are other issues that are considered wedge issues, like pulling down the monuments, where the vast majority of people in the exit polls said they actually agreed with Gillespie's opinion, which was leave him up.
And yet they didn't vote for him.
And yet they didn't vote for him. And my point of that is that there's a tendency to, again, to want to spread this out to 10 or 20 issues and say, oh, here's what the people said. We don't know what they said yet. What we do know, though, is on those issues, even if they agreed with the Republican, they didn't vote for him, which means they were voting on other issues. I think certainly there is concerns about health care, and that was probably a number one issue. I think also you got the unique thing that Virginia's economy is actually people had a higher opinion of their economy here than they do in most states. So I think that was beneficial. And they have a relatively high view of the existing governor. Increasingly, too, Virginia is becoming bluer and bluer and bluer. So I think that you got to give the Democrats credit for their wins and congratulate them. But I think you also get into very dangerous territory when you start to say, OK, that means that America in the last 12 months has completely changed their opinion on guns or on transgender issues or on monuments or on immigration or anything else. Yeah. I'm not sure that's what anybody said.
Well, and Angela, your party has another problem, as you well know. The revelations from former DNC chair Donna Brazile that, you know, the 2016 election, people are using the word rigged, people like Elizabeth Warren, was rigged, that the party, you know, threw its weight behind Hillary Clinton in exchange for some funding. You know, people are furious about that. You know, as you mentioned, there were a lot of gains, you know, in seats flipped, but they'd have to flip 24 Republican seats. Can they overcome these internal divisions to do that?
Well, I think that the Democrats aren't alone in party division. I think that there's a very real party divide in the Republican Party as well. The challenge here, of course, is that there's a lot more housekeeping that has to be done than I think what was apparent to the naked eye to people who aren't as involved in party politics. It is certainly challenging. I think it certainly doesn't help the Clinton campaign's narrative. But one thing I can say is that when you look at the exit polls from yesterday, black and brown voters showed up overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. You had Asian candidates on the ballot that did very, very well. The Democrats are known to be the big tent party. It is time to listen to the rest of the tent. It's time to hire the rest of the tent. Folks in communities of color know how to reach folks in communities of color like no one else. Women know how to reach women. Folks who are in the LGBTQIA community know how to reach each other like nobody else. We've got to start ensuring that all of those folks have a seat at the table, and it's one that's equitable. We've got to ensure that, and I think that's the path forward for Democrats, and I think we saw that really clearly yesterday.
John, we just have a few seconds, but you think President Trump's happy he's all the way around the world when this election news came out?
Well, yeah, but it didn't prevent him from immediately throwing Ed Gillespie under the bus, so to speak.
Right.
And I was disappointed by that. I mean, look, Ed's a good guy. I think Ed's an honest candidate who happened to lose. And I think trying to distance yourself from him as quickly as you can is probably not the right approach.
That's John Brabender, Republican strategist, and Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Jeremy and Robert.
President Trump is in China after a state visit to South Korea yesterday, where he addressed the National Assembly in Seoul and reiterated his tough talk on North Korea's nuclear weapons program.
This is a very different administration than the United States has had in the past. Today, I hope I speak not only for our countries, but for all civilized nations. When I say to the North, do not underestimate us and do not try us.
To which CNN reports North Korea's leaders said, we don't care about what that mad dog may utter because we've already heard enough. So how did President Trump do in this important moment last night? Here now, security analyst Jim Walsh is here. He's senior research associate at MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, what'd you think? How'd he do?
Well, you know, Robin, I thought it was a pretty good speech. Now, that doesn't mean I agreed with everything in it, but I thought it was pretty good for this reason. You know, I worry about North Korea. You and I have talked about this. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I worry about is inadvertent war by mistake or miscalculation. But mm-hmm. the other thing I worry about is a U.S.-South Korean alliance that has been dropping like a rock precipitously. And I think that speech to that audience may have stopped the bleeding for a little while and at least offers the promise that we can rebuild what is the critical relationship. You know, people say China is important. Well, you're not solving North Korea without South Korea, your ally. So I think that's a very important relationship. And the president sort of sounded presidential. He didn't do name calling. He didn't do a bunch of stuff he did during his UN General Assembly speech.
Yeah, there was no little, what did he call?
Rocket Man.
Little Rocket Man. And, you know, big props for South Korea's golfers. Got a big round.
Yes.
Big round of applause. But he also went, explain this part of the speech, because I thought it was interesting that he went way back. He mentioned the sinking of the Pueblo, thought to be a spy ship, in 1968, the downing of a spy plane in 1969. I could see a lot of younger people going, what, the Pueblo? What was that? What was the purpose of going back like that?
Well, I think part of it is that's the style he's adopted. You may remember when he gave his speech on Iran certification, he sort of went through the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, which has been a difficult one. And in this, what he's, I think, essentially doing is showing solidarity with the South Koreans, which is why I love the first half of the speech. It was really an attempt, finally, to reach out to our ally. You know, we still don't have an ambassador to South Korea, but at least the president is doing the right thing here. And I think by going through that history, what he's trying to do is say, we're with you all the way for all these various reasons, and that we share this long history together, and we should continue together going into the future.
Yeah. He also addressed China and Russia by name. Let's listen.
We call on every nation, including China and Russia, to fully implement UN Security Council resolutions, downgrade diplomatic relations with the regime, and sever all ties of trade and technology. It is our responsibility and our duty to confront this danger together, because the longer we wait, the greater the danger grows, and the fewer the options become.
Jim Walsh, is this really what the U.S. wants for both China and Russia, to cut all ties with North Korea? Don't you then have no ties with North Korea? Don't you then have, you know, the more that it has no food, no support, isn't the reckless leadership going to be even more reckless?
That's a great point, Robin, and not many people have brought that up with me. But I think you're on to something. If everyone isolates North Korea, if it is completely alone, it seems to me the chances of them making a mistake or acting out increase, not decrease. You want to have someone, you want to have an open door somewhere, a line of communication. And especially if you expect an agreement, if you're hoping you're going to get an agreement with North Korea to freeze their nuclear missile programs, well, they have to have a friend that's going to guarantee that the other parties do what they say they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And that's China. So if China and North Korea, ironically, if they have a bad relationship, that means North Korea won't trust anyone, and that reduces the chances you can get an agreement.
Yeah, and maybe there's something else going on behind the scenes. One can hope. Hey, by the way, he is in China. What does he have to do there regarding North Korea?
Well, I think they have to between the two of them, they both want North Korea not to have a nuclear weapon. But the Americans want to squeeze North Korea so much that they're to the verge of collapse. The Chinese say, hey, that's a country that's on our border. That would be terrible. We're willing to help, but we're not going to do that. They have to find a middle ground, and they have to find ways collectively to reduce the chance, as we said before, of accidental war by mistake or miscalculation, because that's really how things could unravel quickly.
I just want to listen to a little bit where he did address the North Korean leader directly. Let's listen.
North Korea is not the paradise your grandfather envisioned. It is a hell that no person deserves.
A smackdown. Kim Jong-un's grandfather, Kim Il-sung. Is that useful, taunting someone's grandfather?
Probably not. And of course, there was reporting prior to his UN General Assembly speech that the CIA profiler on North Korea had warned him not to make personal insults, and that happened anyway. You know, there was the talk of the cult. So he sort of inched up close to where he was before on that UN General Assembly speech. But in the main, I would say that it was more or less a speech you might hear from other presidents under other similar circumstances. Yes, a little more out there, but closer to the norm. And I welcome that when things are so delicate at this moment.
Jim Walsh, Senior Research Associate at MIT Security Studies Program. Here and now is Security Analyst. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the future of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program is uncertain. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer told reporters yesterday that Democrats will push to include protections for Dreamers in the bill to fund the government that Congress must pass in December. But last week, President Trump met with Senate Republicans, and they agreed to oppose including provisions for DACA in that bill. There are hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who came to this country as kids and have been shielded from deportation by DACA. But for one student at Furr High School in Houston, the announced end of DACA came at the worst possible time. Laura Eisensee from Houston Public Media explains.
When Maritza and her little brother get home from school, they usually grab a snack and chat with their mom. The after-school routine is one of the few things that still feels normal since Harvey flooded their East Houston home. Maritza shows me the living room.
Before we had the hurricane, we had a couch by the wall. We had another couch over here. We had a stand right here where we would put, like, my little brother's movies and games.
Now the room is empty, except for a quinceañera portrait of Maritza in a red ball gown hanging on the wall. She says they threw out a lot of moldy furniture and soggy carpet.
I was just so frustrated seeing my house like that. Yeah. It was really hard. And my mom, she tried to be really positive, but I know that she felt like she wanted to give us more.
Something else was weighing on Maritza. She's in the country illegally. Some of her family brought her here from Mexico when she was 3 years old. We're using her middle name to protect her identity. Maritza had planned to apply for DACA when she started her senior year at Furr. But just a few days after Harvey hit Houston, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions gave a speech on immigration.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
I wanted to cry, but I didn't. I talked to my mom.
Maritza listened as Attorney General Sessions justified the new, tougher stance.
There's nothing compassionate about the failure to enforce immigration laws.
Maritza was stunned. For months, her family had saved about $1,000 to pay the DACA application fee and a lawyer. The only thing she needed were some school records. But her school was shut down for 2 weeks due to Harvey, right when the government cut off any new applications.
I feel like bad thing after bad thing after bad thing.
Maritza's mom told her not to give up.
She said, you know, things happen for a reason, and just because he took it out doesn't mean that you can't go to school. Like, we will figure it out like we always do.
Maritza's near the top of her class, and Texas does allow undocumented students to enroll in public colleges. But without DACA, she has fewer ways to pay for college, like scholarships. And even if she earns her degree, there's no guarantee she can get a job down the road.
It's not a unique situation, unfortunately, especially here in Houston with Harvey.
Jill Campbell is an attorney at Baker Ripley, a social services agency.
When we knew that DACA was going to be canceled because the administration was kind of hinting at it, the rest of the country got to rush last-minute applications out the door. And we, unfortunately, were underwater and couldn't do that.
We asked federal officials if they would make an exception for applicants like Maritza. They said no. This could affect thousands of students in the Houston School District. Superintendent Richard Carranza estimates 1 in 10 are dreamers, and he promises to support them.
We cannot lose you, and we will not abandon you. I believe in finding a solution where these dreamers can keep reaching their dreams in the United States of America, a nation of immigrants.
Congress has until early March to replace DACA, but Maritza's not counting on it. She realizes, like Hurricane Harvey, the situation is out of her control.
Si sigues pensando negativo, cosas negativas te van a pasar. If you keep thinking negative, negative things are going to happen to you.
For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
And it was a landslide in Kansas City. Voters yesterday overwhelmingly approved a $1 billion plan to build a new airport. The campaign was getting lots of attention during our trip to Kansas City last month. People watching the race thought it would be close, but last night, 75% of voters said they wanted to replace KCI's cramped aging terminals with a brand new one. KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez has been following the story and joins us now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jeremy.
So when we reported on this, we met people who loved this airport because its gates are so close to the curb. We also found out that a lot of frequent flyers really hate it. Remind us of the pitch that supporters of a new airport were making.
Well, first of all, they promised that any new airport, any new terminal would be just as convenient, if not more. They promised wider gates to accommodate for larger airplanes. And they also said that once you're past security, they promised more amenities, more restaurants and bars and bathrooms. If you remember when you were here, in our current setup and because of the time the airport was built, most of those bathrooms and restaurants are outside of the secure area. So once you're past security, there's not much besides, you know, wrapped sandwiches and bottled water.
Yeah, we heard a lot about that. Let's listen here to Mona Bailey, who talked to us. She said she liked the airport, but still wanted a new one.
It's very convenient, but if you've ever been stuck in an airport, there's no place to eat here. I was just through Houston. Oh, man, they've got updates every place. And it was fast and quick, and there was places to eat.
How surprised are people that this won with 75% of the vote?
People are stunned. I think despite the talk about having razor-thin margins, people did expect it to pass, but certainly not by a landslide. So I think, you know, in fact, talking about it being neck and neck may have mobilized some of those complacent yes voters out to the polls.
We heard a lot of arguments from supporters that this would help the business community in Kansas City and attract new airlines. Have we heard anything today from the airlines or local companies?
Well, I talked to our deputy aviation director yesterday, and he said that even last night, his phone had been buzzing from airlines and other stakeholders outside of Kansas City that were interested in the outcome of the vote. So while we can't guarantee any new flights yet, we certainly know that people in the industry are paying attention and they're watching.
And by the way, people in Kansas City got to vote on this. They will not have to pay for it, right? The money for this new terminal is going to come from airport user fees, parking revenues, and from the airlines.
Right. And I think that's a big game changer. One of the reasons for this kind of sea change in Kansas City is that once an idea was brought up that would guarantee that this wouldn't be paid for on the backs of taxpayers, that changed the conversation quite a bit.
So the plan is to have the new terminal open by 2021?
Absolutely. So the developers have promised a really quick turnaround. They'll work in the next couple weeks to finalize a design, to get those financing details worked out. And they're hoping to break ground late summer, early fall of 2018.
Well, I guess I should stay neutral on this, but I must say, as I was flying out of Kansas City, I had to wait in line for like a half an hour in the security line. And I thought, if I could vote, I would have voted the way that Kansas City did for a new terminal.
Well, yeah, a majority of Kansas City agreed with you.
That's KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And it's open enrollment season for the Affordable Care Act. Yes, it's still alive, despite the president's and Republicans' attempts to kill it. Here he is on October 17th.
Obamacare is a disaster. It's virtually dead. As far as I'm concerned, it really is dead. And I predicted that a long time ago.
But on November 1st, the first day of open enrollment, more than 200,000 Americans chose a plan. That's twice the number that enrolled on the first day last year. Lori Lodes ran outreach and public education for the Affordable Care Act under President Obama. After the Trump administration cut funding for advertising and educating people about enrollment by 90%, she co-founded the nonprofit Get America Covered with Joshua Peck to try to get the word out. So, Lori, people can sign up for healthcare coverage through healthcare.gov or their state exchanges, and they did. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised. I am heartened. One of the things that we were worried about is that the administration had done so little to get the word out about open enrollment and, in fact, had done a lot to undermine it that we didn't know where people were going to be. I think it goes to show it's not about politics for them. Mm-hmm. It's about their lives and about making sure them and their families have the care they need to stay healthy. And then, two, affordable care is available. Trump has talked about, oh, the rates, they're skyrocketing. Obamacare is dead. But the reality is, for most people, healthcare is cheaper this year than ever before.
Well, let's just stay with the cuts to the advertising. The budget was cut from $100 to $10 million. Maybe the advertising isn't needed to get people.
Oh, I would say the exact opposite. What I'm thinking about is, you know, the missed opportunity. If only they were doing everything they needed to do or should be doing to make sure that people get the information they need to get covered, think about what those enrollment numbers would be like. And we still have a long way to go. It's so important that we get the word out to people before December 15th. And we just don't know what the administration is going to do to help get us there.
Well, and by the way, December 15th, we can't say that enough because the Trump administration also cut the enrollment time. It's half as long as it was last year, so people need to know that. Why is advertising so important for healthy people?
It is so important to get younger and healthier people into the marketplace. If you're young, if you're healthy, you might not be thinking about your healthcare coverage right now unless you are reminded that you have to take action before December 15th and that financial help is available. And so what we want to make sure they know is that 8 out of 10 people qualify for financial help and that most people can find plans for $75 and many of them can even find health plans that cost $0.
Are you worried, though, that the Trump administration also cut the subsidies to insurance companies to help them cover, you know, not the very, very poor, those people are on Medicaid, but the lower income who have this, you know, chance at getting coverage with a subsidy?
Well, the great news is if you qualify for financial help, the financial help you get this year will be more than it was last year or the year before. we're talking by about 75%. And the reason that is because of the Trump administration's decision to not continue making the payments on the cost sharing reduction. And so what that means is that financial help went up just as much as premiums went up.
Do you think that's a part of it, the reason so many people have signed up, is that it's really dawning on them that it might go away?
Not necessarily that it's going to go away, although we do know that there is a chunk of people who either think the law was repealed or think it could go away. But I think having a year-long conversation about taking it away has made people more cognizant of their life choices and what's happening. And so I think they were maybe more ready this year than they have been in years past.
The Trump administration also gutted the Navigator programs. These are community-oriented organizations who help people sign up. What's the impact there?
You know, it really depends on the city and the state, these community groups who are responsible for doing a lot of the hard work to make sure that people on the ground have the help they need. They sort of have been recommitted. So although their budgets have been cut, although their staffing has been cut, they are really stepping up to the challenge and making sure that they are doing everything this year they can to get people covered.
Now, the Kaiser Family Foundation found about 80% of people looking for this help lacked the confidence to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. A third didn't have internet. 18% needed translation. Remind people, make your pitch. You know, the very, very poor are covered by Medicaid. Many other Americans are lucky enough to have employer insurance. Who should be thinking about this open enrollment?
Honestly, anyone who doesn't have healthcare coverage or who has individual coverage not through healthcare.gov, and healthcare.gov and the state exchanges are the only places you can get healthcare with financial help. And that financial help will lower your monthly premiums. And quite often, depending on what your income is, you could even get additional savings with lower deductibles and lower out-of-pocket expenses. So I think this year, with the options that are available, it is more important than ever that people visit healthcare.gov or visit their state-based exchange to find out what options are available for them, because I think many people are going to be surprised.
Lori Lotus, who ran outreach and public education for the Affordable Care Act under President Obama and is now co-founded Get America Covered. We'll link you at hereandnow.org and some great articles on how to think about choosing insurance if you go to the state exchanges or healthcare.gov. And you must go by December 15th in most states. Lori, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, meanwhile, in Maine yesterday, voters overwhelmingly approved question two to extend Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act to more than 70,000 people there. This morning, Maine's Governor Paul LePage said in a statement he wouldn't implement the expansion until the legislature funds it, but Medicaid is a federal program. The state funding is usually much smaller. Maine is the first state to expand Medicaid through a citizens' initiative. Patty White from Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
It's a long-awaited victory for supporters of Medicaid expansion who've watched the legislature enact bills to expand the insurance program over the past several years, only to be vetoed by Governor Paul LePage five times. That's what prompted Robin Merrill, co-chair of the coalition Mainers for Healthcare, to take the matter to the ballot box, and the strategy worked.
We did it!
Merrill and Question 2 supporters could barely contain their excitement for the victory and for the history Maine made on Tuesday as the first state to expand Medicaid through a citizens' initiative.
Maine is sending a strong and weighty message to politicians in Augusta and across the country. We need more affordable health care, not less.
Maine will now join the 31 states that have already expanded Medicaid to cover adults with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That's about $16,000 for an individual and $34,000 for a family of four. Currently, people within that income bracket fall into a coverage gap created when the Supreme Court made Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act optional. They earn too much to qualify for subsidies under the ACA and too little to afford insurance on their own. Kathleen Phelps, a hairdresser from Waterville, is one of those people.
Finally, maybe now people like myself can get the health care we need.
Phelps lost her Medicaid coverage 4 years ago and says she had to go without the medication and oxygen she needs for her emphysema and COPD. But because of Maine voters, she says, she'll get it back.
I will have oxygen back in my home, and I'll sleep good at night.
The passage of Question 2 is also a win for the state's hospitals. More than half are in the red, according to the Maine Hospital Association. Spokesman Jeff Austin says hospitals also provide more than $100 million a year in charity care. Expanding coverage will restore some fiscal health, he says, and give doctors and nurses more options to treat their formerly uninsured patients.
There are just avenues of care that open up when you see a patient, from recommending a prescription drug or seeing a counselor. You know, doors that were closed previously will now be open.
The federal government will kick in 94% of the cost of Medicaid expansion in 2018. That lowers to 90% by 2020. The State Office of Fiscal and Program Review estimates it will bring in $500 million federal dollars a year, a deal that Question 2 supporters say Maine couldn't refuse. But opponents, including Brent Littlefield of the Welfare to Work PAC, point to the state cost, which is projected to be about $50 million a year.
The legislature has to somehow come up with the money for this large government expansion, and there is no money there to pay for that. So now the legislature has to ask themselves, how do we pay for this? And that is likely to result in cuts or likely a push for tax increases.
Medicaid expansion will now be in the hands of the legislature, which changed, delayed, or overturned four ballot initiatives that Maine voters passed last year. But Robin Merrill says she's confident that lawmakers will implement Medicaid expansion quickly. After all, she says, they've passed it five times before. For Here and Now, I'm Patty White in Lewiston, Maine.
We're learning more about the shooter in Sutherland Springs, Texas. More red flags that were ignored. It turns out that in addition to escaping from a mental health facility and being charged with domestic violence and animal cruelty, he had an obsession with guns and mass shootings. He was still able to get the guns he needed for his massacre. But for many, including President Trump, now is not the time to talk about gun control. Joining us now is Mike Weiser, who is the author of the blog Mike the Gun Guy. He's also a firearms instructor, and he blogs for the Huffington Post. He joins us on Skype. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, one of the things that we've been hearing as we've been covering what happened in Sutherland Springs is that many of the people there and many gun owners around the country do not want to talk about gun control as a result of what happened. As a gun owner yourself, what do you think?
Well, I think that this is a defensive reaction to something that, you know, has now become kind of ingrained in American culture. What you really have is a gun-owning population which has just become convinced from a cultural point of view that anything negative that's said about guns is going to end up with them not being able to own guns. You know, and as much as these poor folks in Texas are searching for answers, the only answer is that the guy who walked into the church had a gun.
And shouldn't have had a gun based on some of his past.
And shouldn't have had a gun. And as a matter of fact, whenever the gun control community argues for an expansion of the background checks, one of the current responses is, well, and this has been going on for years, well, let's fix the system that we have now before we make it larger. And the truth is that they happen to be correct.
Some people look at what just happened in Texas and they say, well, if only the people who were in the church had guns, they could have defended themselves. They could have stopped this from unfolding. What do you think about that?
Two things. First of all, the idea that in a small town, Baptist church in rural Texas, that there weren't people in the church with guns is absurd. And why nobody jumped up with a gun is because people aren't trained to do that. And if you're sitting in a church and you're praying and, you know, it's a moment of quiet and solitude and everything else, even if you've got a gun and somebody comes in, opens the front door and starts blasting away, you're going to do what everybody does. You're going to hit the floor. The idea that the average citizen, even if he's had a little bit of, I don't want to call it training, just experience in using a gun, because it's not training. Okay? You don't get trained by just a little time at the range and having some guy tell you, okay, you know, point the gun here, bang, bang, bang. That's not training.
Well, how much training would you need to actually take aim and fire at the shooter? We see on TV, you know, it looks like everybody can just pull the gun out and aim and fire and do it right, but it's not that simple.
You would need more training than 50% of the sworn active law enforcement officers in this country ever get. And by the way, when you go to the range, of course, even if you're shooting at a target, the target is standing still. A person doesn't stand still. So if we don't even have a minimum standard, not for training, but for performance validation for our law enforcement, how in God's name is anybody going to say, well, just because you have a gun in your pocket, you know how to use it in self-defense? You don't. The idea that if you, you know, you go, you buy a gun, you a couple of hundred rounds, you know, on the range, and now you can protect yourself from crime in a way you couldn't do before. Now, there's no question that Americans have become, and all the surveys show this, Americans have become more fearful of, I don't know what, but of something. Americans have become more convinced that a gun makes you safer and protects you, even among people who don't own guns. But, you know, I think we all understand the fact that what people believe and what people think doesn't necessarily align with the reality of any situation. And this is certainly true in this case.
So it's been just a few days since the shooting in Texas. It's been more than a month now since the mass shooting in Las Vegas. Nothing was done at the federal level on bump stocks. Do you expect anything will be done on gun control after the Sutherland Springs shooting?
The only time that the federal government has passed a gun control law in the last 50 years has been when there was a Southern liberal in the White House and a blue Congress. That alignment not only doesn't exist, we're about as far away from it as we could ever be.
That's Michael Weiser, who is the author of the blog Mike the Gun Guy. He's a firearms instructor who teaches gun safety courses. Mike, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Anytime. Take care.
And your thoughts are welcome at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.